The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and Chicago. And if you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Leeds, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
How was your mini vacation?
Fantastic. It was 97 degrees and hot and sunny and all that great stuff.
You like that, huh?
Considering what it's been like in Cleveland for the last year or so, yeah.
Well, I have to thank you for bringing back the heat and humidity. I never, ever complain about hot weather.
You're welcome.
I do have a quick update on House Bill 145, also known as the three-foot rule bill. We spoke with Ohio bike lawyer and Ohio Bicycle Federation board member Steve Magus last week. And on Tuesday, the Ohio House passed the bill 7-2, shipped it off to the Senate for further action. Evidently, next Tuesday, it may come up for vote. So there. You have a shout out.
I have a shout out for our rowing and cycling friend Paul, who decided to do, on his road bike, going to ride with some other friends, decided to do a little bit of off-road, did an endo and fixed his flat tire, went back after the ride was over, went home and wasn't feeling well in the middle of the night and decided to go to the hospital. And turns out he's got some broken things in his neck.
Nice.
So he won't be riding for a while.
Guess
or
not.
Rowing. He'll have one of those little fun halos up on top. And I just hope he mends quickly.
Well, there you have it. We have a big show tonight.
Big show.
Big show. So having lived most of my last 40 years in a bike shop, I've seen the evolution of drivetrains go from 5 speeds to 11. Carbon and titanium have become as normal as steel and aluminum. And electronic shifting is beginning to show up on more than just the high-end road racing machines. But in his new book, The Bike Deconstructed, A Grand Tour of the Modern Bicycle, author, frame builder, and tech guru Richard Hallett does just that. He deconstructs the bicycle into all its many parts with photographs, diagrams, and dialogue that also includes a lot of history. It's a nice book. It's one of those put it on your coffee table books. We'll also speak with David Brumley. David is an athlete who, by all rights, should probably be happy just to walk to the end of his driveway and back. He suffers from what most doctors consider to be a debilitating disease known as primary immunodeficiency disease, or PI. But in 2008, a question from his then 3-year-old daughter gave him the wake-up call he needed to begin looking at his life differently. Although he absolutely believes he will never win a race, he wins every time he puts on his riding or running gear and hits the pavement. Now David wants others to know about his disease, what it is, how it manifests itself, and what can be done about it. In pursuit of those things, he launched a campaign called Try, T-R-I, for Better, and he's training for his first Ironman in September. It's quite a story. After a break, we're going to Africa. Yes, we are. We're going over to Uganda. And if you've ever heard any of the voices of the Tour de France, you would recognize my final guest this evening immediately. Paul Sherwin has more accessible knowledge of pro cycling in his brain than most of us have in books on our shelves. He uses that knowledge to help us stay abreast of every stage in the Tour de France, right alongside his buddy Phil Liggett. This evening, we're going to learn more about Paul, how he became one of those famous voices, and what he thinks about this year's tour. So it's a big show. Let's get right to it. We're going to head on over to the UK and speak with author and tech guru Richard Hallett. Richard, thanks so much for joining me on the show this evening.
It's a pleasure.
Good. We're going to delve into your new book, The Bike Deconstructed, A Grand Tour of the Modern Bicycle. Tell us a bit about your background first.
Okay, so I've been a serious cyclist for about 40 years. Started when I was in my early teens, and joined a cycling club when I was 15 or 16. So I've been a bike racer, road racing, track racing, time trials. I've raced on tandems, I've raced tricycles, held a few UK tandem records. And then about 20 years ago, I got into cycle journalism, so I've been covering cycle technology for various UK publications, all the big ones such as Cycling Weekly, Cycle Sport, Pro Cycling, and so on, for about the last 20 years. About 8 or 9 years ago, I became editor of a website called roadcyclinguk.com.
We quote you occasionally.
Do you?
Yes, we do, and we give you credit, I promise.
Yeah. Okay. And so more recently, I've taken up bicycle frame building. So I produce my own steel frames now as well.
Lovely. Are they brazed frames?
Brazed, fillet brazed, silver soldered. Yeah. I don't weld, and they're all done in steel.
Very nice. We're big steel fans here. We like that. So yeah. Your province, though, is really technology. And what's interesting about your book, and I had somebody looking at it about an hour ago, and one of the things she said was, wow, I understand what he's saying here. So that's a good thing. Even though it's a technological book, it's done in a way that anybody can read it and understand it. So define modern, because you subtitle the book, A Grand Tour of the Modern Bicycle. What do you consider modern?
Okay, well, first of all, thanks for your kind words about the way it's written. Actually, A Grand Tour of the Modern Bicycle is the United States version of the book. I actually called it A Grand Tour of the Road Bicycle, and it's been renamed The Modern Bicycle for the U.S. market for some
reason. Why is that? Why would we deserve or need a different version of it?
I don't know. You really would have to publish it. I mean, in the introduction, I define the road bicycle as being a bicycle that prioritizes performance over simply utility. In other words, you know, a utility bicycle in Europe would be one with flat handlebars, you know, maybe a chain case, that kind of thing. Traditionally used for getting to work, going shopping, and so on. Whereas a road bicycle is something which is a bit more performance orientated. So you'd have drop handlebars, you've got clipless pedals, you've got fast tires, and you've got multiple gearing and that kind of thing. Obviously, if you read the bicycle, because there is in the book, there's a fair bit of historical stuff in it, which might seem odd in the context of a modern bicycle, but that wasn't really how I originally planned it.
No, and in fact, we're going to go sort of how you've got the book laid out, and the historical part of it is a very integral and important part, I thought. You and I might, or our listeners might, think of the bicycle as something simple, but one of the things that struck me in the book was how unsimple it is. You have a sort of a two-page double truck picture of the deconstructed parts of the bicycle diagram, and you do, in fact, discuss every single part. And when you start looking at it that way, it's a lot of pieces.
It is, although luckily for the reader, I actually resisted the publisher's request to strip it down even further into ball bearings and that kind of thing. I mean, you know, bicycles are very simple things, but of course they are a collection of lots of small, simple components. You know, so if you put them all together, they end up looking like a pretty complex machine. But it's complex in terms of the way all its parts work together, rather than in terms of the way individual parts work.
I guess what I'd like to do is sort of talk about how you've gone through the book, and each chapter begins with a little bit of history and then moves on to the technical aspects of the book. For example, your first chapter is materials, and materials are always an important conversation on our show because we talk a lot about how steel is real. You know, there's been aluminum, and today titanium and carbon fiber are pretty much considered...
They are at the top level of performance, yeah. Okay, so the reason I did it like that is because I think that if you want to understand why titanium and carbon fiber have taken over from steel for racing, it's worth knowing why steel was used in the first place. So even a consideration of things like the size of tubes that were, you know, traditional tube sizes for steel frames, you know, they decided on them before the turn of the 19th century, because they just found by trial and error that they were the sizes that worked in steel. Now, obviously, what you then ended up with was something with a certain kind of performance, you know, due to the size of the steel tubes. And then, obviously, over the years, right up until the 1990s, steel frames got lighter and lighter as steel alloys got better, you know, stronger, and they made lighter tubes. But eventually, you ended up with something which was, at the time, the peak of what you could do with steel. And when aluminium and then titanium and then carbon fiber came along, they could then be used to make a lighter frame. But in terms of understanding why they're better, I think you need to know why steel is good.
Well, we can simply explain why steel is good. I mean, they did evolve into oversized tubes, and then the air hardened, and then you had 753 and 853 from Reynolds. So there have been a lot of steel variations over the years. And as you said, you still make a steel frame.
Yes. Well, I mean, in fact, of course, what's happened is that in the last 10 years, steel tubes have improved again. You know, so today's steel tubes are considerably better than the ones that were around at the, let's say, 15 years ago when steel began to fade from the scene. So, I mean, if you could, in fact, there's a professional bike racing team in Britain racing on steel frames now. They race on Reynolds 953.
Nice.
So, yeah, I mean, steel is pretty close to the performance of carbon fiber. I personally would say that steel is better than titanium and aluminium as a frame material. And better in some respects than carbon, but obviously not as light.
So let me ask you something about your research when you were doing the history of all these different parts and the history of each of the beginnings of each chapter. Were there any surprises that you came upon as you were assembling this book?
Well, okay. I mean, I've been writing about bike technology and stuff for, like I said, for over 20 years. And so I've built up a pretty good grasp of you know, the history, the way bicycle history has developed, which is one reason why I decided to do it that way. But yes, I mean, the one thing that really struck me actually was that, of course, you'll be familiar with the growing popularity of disc brakes for bicycles.
Yes.
For road bikes. Obviously, they've been fitment on mountain bikes for a few years now, but they're starting to come into road bikes, and everybody is saying, well, you know, disc brakes will be standard fitment before long because everybody will appreciate the extra braking. But if you go back to the 1920s, when drum brakes were much, much more powerful, much more reliable than the rim brakes of the time, and they were readily available, but only a very small part of the cycling community would have drum brakes. You know, and in fact, the disadvantages of drum brakes, as I point out in the book, are pretty much the same as the disadvantages of disc brakes. In other words, they make wheel removal and replacement slower. They make the bicycle less comfortable and so on. And of course, in the 1920s, people didn't really see the advantages of drum brakes as outweighing the disadvantages. And I'll be interested to see if disc brakes really do take over on road bikes in the long term, because, you know, rim brakes for bicycles actually work very well.
Me too. I agree with you. We talk about that all the time. I've spoken with people like Leonard Zinn and Craig Calfee, and I always say, are you sure disc brakes are the right thing? You know, are the forks strong enough? That was something that came up for me. Are these forks strong enough? You know, are you going to get a lot of pushback on a road fork? So I don't know.
Well, it's certainly the case. If you try fitting a disc brake caliper mount to a regular steel fork blade, then the blade itself will fatigue over time.
Sure.
on the front of the blade, and so they do need to be reinforced. And so you then end up with something which is heavier, less flexible. So the ride, you know, the sort of ride comfort suffers, and the whole bicycle is about a pound heavier with disc brakes than it is without them. I've ridden some, and they never feel quite as fast to me as bikes with the rim brakes.
Interesting. I'm speaking with Richard Hallett. His new book, The Bike Deconstructed, A Grand Tour of the Modern Bicycle, which is our U.S. version, unfortunately. I think I would have liked the other version just as well. It's from the Princeton Architectural Press. It's a paperback, but it's really beautiful. How long did it take you? Did you take these photos? Who took all these beautiful photographs?
I'll have to confess, I only actually wrote the book.
Okay. That's a good confession.
they had some, obviously had some good picture researchers, and some of the stuff was shot in the studio for the books. Obviously the visual presentation of the book is a large part of it, and they did a very good job. We were lucky to have a couple of local, I think Enigma bikes let us have some frames for the shoot, and Trek bicycles as well. The Trek dealer in the UK is very good.
Oh, well, that's good to know. That's always good to know. So I'm going to ask you about a bike of your own. Obviously, you are building bikes now. You're both Brazing, Philip Brazing. If you were to assemble the bike of your dreams, which you probably already have, what would it consist of? Frame, obviously, would be steel.
Yep.
Would you still use a steel fork?
Yes. And in fact, I'm riding around on it now. So,
what kind of wheels are you riding?
Okay, so I decided to try this. I suppose one of the new trends that's come along is something called 650B, and I think there's a publication in the States called Bicycle Quarterly, and the guys there have been championing this wheel size for a while.
Yeah, that's
now.
Jan Hein. Yep.
Yeah, he's the one. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I mean these 650B tires have been around since the late 1920s. And they're still quite popular in France. So you can go to France and see bicycles being, you know, really quite old bikes being ridden with them. So they've never gone away. They've been rediscovered, I suppose, in the States by the guys at Bicycle Quarterly. And they do have, well, apparently had many advantages. So I thought I'd build a bicycle to try them out. I've built it. Pictures can be seen on the website of my own brand of bicycle website, and so I bought myself a pair of these extremely light, I think they're called Grand Bois Etre tires, 42 millimeters wide.
Well, that's wide.
Yeah, very fat. They're only 400 grams per tire. Hmm. Beautiful quality, and it's so it's got a steel fork. But obviously, if you're going to fit these tires, you need to make your own fork, because you can't really buy a commercially available fork that will take them. And it's got I'm not sure, so some old cantilever brakes I found in a box in my shed, I think.
Nice.
But drop handlebars and Shimano Ultegra 10 speed transmission.
How do you like the ride of the 650B?
It's so plush that it's like a Rolls Royce. And I mean, I've not ridden it very far yet. I've only just built it, but it's absolutely nice. Beautiful ride.
What is your website, Richard?
It's called HallettHandBuiltCycles.com.
Okay, we'll add that to our Facebook page. And I really like your book. I think it's one of those that if you really want to know about the bicycle from the nitty-gritty inside to out, it's one to have on your shelf. It's really excellent. Covers pedals, covers quick releases, covers hubs, tires, everything. It's called The Bike Deconstructed, A Grand Tour of the Modern Bicycle by Richard Hallett. And I hope you do very well with it. Where can people get it?
Well, in the UK, you can buy it from, you know, the big book retailers such as Waterstones. I'm not sure about in the US, but certainly you can buy it on Amazon's and other online suppliers. So.
Okay. I wish you a lot of luck with it, and I wish we had more time to talk, but we will talk again, because I think you have a lot to say, and we talk to frame builders all the time. We like frame builders.
We'll take a look at my website. That's what you think.
I will indeed. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Have a lovely evening.
Yep, and you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Richard Hallett joined me from his home in London. The book is very nice. Again, The Bike Deconstructed. We're going to scurry on down to McKinney, Texas, and talk with triathlete, David Brumley. David, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I read a story about you, and I really wanted to know more. It said you were, at the age of 39, physically dormant and low strength and energy, and yet now you're training for a triathlon and an Ironman triathlon. So I'd like to know a little bit about your background, because I think there are going to be people who are going to hear what you're going to say and say, wow, that might be me. So tell us about your background, about that statement, and what CVID is.
I was an individual that was sick as a kid and struggled through adolescence and then midlife with always getting sick and just recurring infections. And once I basically reached college, it just got too much of a struggle. I couldn't stay physically active. It was just physically active, physically impossible to physically active because I would just get sick. And so when I reached, it was really around 34 years old, when I reached kind of that tipping point in my health, and I hadn't ridden a bike since I was probably in middle school. I hadn't run since, and the last run I can remember was with a friend when I was a sophomore in college, and I had never swam laps. I had played in the pool like most people, but never actually swam laps. And so to set the stage, when I got involved in sport and triathlon, I had no background. So the basic story was is that I, at age 34, got diagnosed with CVID.
So let me ask a question about the previous years of being sick. Nobody was able to actually look at all of these incidents of illness and test for what they finally found when you were 34?
Right. I'll give you the brief overview. And you bring up one of the biggest topics is primary immune deficiencies, CVID. Well, let's just define it. CVID is common variable immune deficiency. And it is basically just a type of primary immune deficiency. When people think of primary immune deficiency, they think of the boy in the bubble. Some people do. They've seen that movie.
Oh, the boy in the bubble. Yeah.
He had what was called combined as the worst type of primary immune deficiency. So CVID is simply a type of primary immune deficiency. And there are over 200 that are recognized currently.
Wow.
And they range from all sorts of different types of immune deficiency, but they're all primary instead of secondary. Secondary is like HIV. There's an autoimmune response. Those are considered secondary. Primary is generally, usually we say, is genetic. And it's that your body just is not working properly. So that's the quick definition. So for me as a child, I was sick, going on bronchitis, pneumonia, ear infections, throat infections, sinuses, asthma, and I would get bronchitis at least twice a year, pneumonia probably about once a year. And, you know, this continued all the way, you know, through life. But you'd get over it, you'd get better, you'd go back, and doctors would just continually treat the symptom. Okay, you have allergies, so this would do allergies. You have some asthma, so here, take this inhaler. Just bronchitis again. And we had moved, and I went to see a new doctor, and he was going through my whole list of problems, you could say. And he looks at me and goes, I want to test your immune system. And started, it was about a three-month journey of testing.
So he was the first doctor who actually said, let's stop at treating symptoms and try and find the cause?
Yeah, and that was
wow.
Primarily because I kind of got lucky in that it was he was just supposed to be an allergist, but he happened to be their chief immunologist as well. So he knew what he was looking at. And so, you know, he knew what to test, and we did a test it. And for me, my levels were low to non-existent in two of the subclasses. And so the diagnosis is CVID, common variable immune deficiency.
We'll talk about how they treat it in a moment, but there was sort of a defining moment with your daughter when she was three that even though you had all this stuff going on, was that after you were diagnosed?
Right. So
okay.
So what happened for me, because I'd been sick all my life, I was one of those cases that probably went undiagnosed as a child. But I'd survived. I'd learned to survive. Then when my daughter was born, and started taking her to preschool, bringing all these other fun germs, I hit the low that sends you into the doctor, start sending you from doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor. And for probably almost a 3-year time frame, I was on antibiotics, on prednisone, on inhalers, on everything, because I was just sick. I didn't get sick and get well this time. I stayed sick probably about a 2.5-year time frame. So I went through all the testing, and I remember I was sitting on steps of our house I went and sat down on the steps of the house when my doctor called, and I said, okay, what are we going to do about it? And, you know, it's a deep sigh, and says, well, we're going to start you some treatments, and they should help. They should help. And, uh-huh. Right, and that's how most doctors will phrase it, because the truth of it is it does help, but it's not a cure and it's not a fix. And we could talk about treatment in a moment and why that is, and what's really important to the support groups that are out there really trying to increase research and awareness for finding actually either a better treatment or a cure. But that's so here it is. Okay, here's the thing. We know it's wrong with you now, but there's really not much we can do except get this really expensive treatment that might help. And by the way, there is no cure. You're going to live with this the rest of your life, period.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with David Brumley. He is a CVID patient, and he's also a triathlete. And we're going to get to that in a moment, because that is the important thing, that something switched in your head, regardless of how this disease is affecting you, to say, okay, I'm going to be more than my disease.
Right. And that was a year after that from diagnosis, because I got into treatment. And for the most part, I was better. I'd only got sick 4 times in the first year of treatment. Hey, that's actually better. Or rounds of antibiotics and other medications. But my quality of life was no better off. I had no energy. We call it fatigue. And there's really no answer to why our bodies start to shut down like that. I tell people it's simple. You know, your immune system's trying to cover up for what it's missing, so it's working extra hard. I'm not a doctor. I can't really answer that, but I can tell you this, that almost every CVID patient you talk to will tell you some story of fatigue. You know, so I still had the fatigue. I still was eking through life, and you know, be really honest, you go through a real bad season of depression.
So how are you able to do what you're doing? I mean, you're training for an Ironman.
Right. So after a year, I'll be honest with you, I didn't feel any better about myself, about my situation, and about life in general. Because I was now having to watch my exposure, where I went, who I went with, what I did, and these kind of things. And so I was tucking my daughter into bed one night, it'd been about a year, and she literally out of the blue looked up and says, Daddy, when are you going to be sick no more? And that's devastating to have to answer that from your child, because there's nothing that I can say. And I remember walking back downstairs just completely devastated. And my wife was down there training her, and it's raking, and her training partner, due to a triathlon, was taking the year off, and I'm sitting there looking at her. I go, hey, I'll train with you. Why not? And to be honest, at that point in time, I don't know what was going through my head other than sheer desperation. I had to do something, and I didn't have a clue what I was getting into. I didn't have any energy to do it. I had nothing, but it was kind of at that point of desperation, you got to do something. So that's how I got started.
And so your first run, how long was your first run?
One loop around the park. It was about an eighth of a mile, maybe a quarter. I crawled back to the house. I was in pain. It was bad. It was really bad. And my wife had to teach me to slow down. And the first race, the first triathlon I did was a sprint, and I did it with her. And so over, I had about 12 weeks to train. I was sick probably about 4 of them. I made it through it. I rode an old mountain bike we had, and we lived in Denver. So any Denver listeners, great ride, and you know, especially for someone who's never ridden before, up and down hills. And it was, you know, I would put myself in an ice pack because I hurt so bad, because I'm a very type A personality, and I didn't know how to train. I didn't know how to start learning to ride. And so when I came to swimming, I watched a few YouTube videos and jumped in the pool and worked through swimming. And so the first, you know, year, and the first experience was incredible. Made it to the race in one piece. Surprisingly, I felt horrible, you know, because there's so much to say. I mean, I showed up race day exhausted and fatigued, and it wasn't because I had trained too much. It wasn't because of anything I could control. It was my body simply decided to say, David, you're going to be fatigued today. And I wanted to fall asleep on the bike. But it was really cool. Caught up with my wife and, you know, did the run and finished together. And it was just one of those memorable experiences. And after that, you know, through that course, things began to click with me, you know, mentally and emotionally. My body wasn't any better. But emotionally, it was like, you know, I can do this. I can reclaim my life. And you'll never be normal, but I can function more than just hiding and hoping I don't get sick.
When you have one of these days where you just have to say, look, I'm going to go out there and run 5 miles or whatever it is you do, regardless of the fatigue, when you come back, even if you're tired, has there been a change from, say, when you first started training to now? The disease hasn't changed.
Oh, yeah.
But something's changed.
Right, absolutely. You know, we talk about lack of energy, and lack of energy has not changed, but yet it has. In other words, I do have more energy now. And I find that mostly even riding the bike, if I get on the bike and ride for a little bit, aerobic, just have a, you know, just a great ride, I will have more energy. It kicks my body into production because our bodies know how to move. And it starts that production. For me, what's really changed in getting into sport, I mean, since you had, you know, treatment began to marginally help. And when I got into sport, it did make me healthier. And it made me healthier for one real big reason. It taught me to be proactive in everything I did, in my eating, in my sleeping, and my stress and my exposure, because I'd spent, you know, 30 plus years before being reactive, getting sick, treatment. And what sport taught me was how to be proactive, how to eat to fuel, to if I'm feeling really lethargic one day, and for instance, like yesterday, I felt really miserable, really lethargic. Instead of being reactive on that day, everything I did that day was thinking, what can I do to set the stage to not feel this way tomorrow? And so that really changed it. And now 6 years later from diagnosis, you know, my breathing function is off the charts better. I don't use inhalers anymore.
Wow.
You could say I don't have asthma anymore. I don't wheeze. Will I from time to time? Yeah. If I get super sick, my occurrence of infection the past couple of years has been way, way down. Usually one big round a year.
So I want to talk about your wanting to give back, your try for better. And that's the last thing we're going to be able to talk about tonight. And so tell us about this organization that you've put together for people like you who are looking for a way to have their lives be much more than they've been in the past.
Right. You know, it all started, Try for Better, it's just an initiative to inspire those with primary immune deficiency to try for better, to try to move their lives into a better place, obviously through sport. But it's began to reach beyond that to individuals with chronic illness, period. That when you're looking at such desperation and lack of hope, to simply make that effort to try. And what I like to tell people is that we have to stop waiting to feel better, to do something to be better. And that's a powerful thought when you really let it sink in, because if you don't have anything wrong with your body, it's easy to wait to feel better because you might feel better in 2 days. When you have a chronic illness like CVID, you don't know if you're going to feel better tomorrow. I can't guarantee that I'm going to have a good day tomorrow. And I have a race Sunday, and I cannot guarantee that I'm going to do everything I'm supposed to do and still wake up ready to race any morning, because my body could simply flip the switch and say, you know what, today you're not going to feel that great. So I really wanted to challenge people and inspire them, encourage them, and equip them to say, okay, I'm not going to wait to feel better. I'm going to go ahead and do what I know I should be doing to be better. And I guarantee you that not only will you begin to be better physically, but emotionally, you'll learn to accept your situation and be able to move it forward, and you'll be able to be better. And what I found in my daughter's challenge, you know, dad, when are you going to be sick no more? For me, as dad, when are you going to be better? I found through sport what it taught me, and through better care of myself, that it made me a better person, better father, better husband, better friend. And that's the real takeaway. So Try for Better is just, it's all about just inspiring people to get out there and try.
Well, what a story. And you're training for an Ironman Louisville?
Ironman Louisville, yeah. I wanted to do something big this year. I've
That's
never done a full
big.
Ironman. Yeah, I've never done a full Ironman.
Yeah, only crazy people do Ironman, David. I'm just kidding.
Well, that's what I hear, and it's been an interesting year. I mean, I had a bad bike crash about a month ago, and a scar fracture a few months ago. I fractured my thumb on the crash, and, you know, messed up my arm and shoulder. But, yeah, we move on.
That's
the beautiful thing about cyclists is, you know, we know how to pretend we're not hurt. We keep on riding. But I wanted to say that I really encourage listeners that if you have questions, check out primaryimmune.org. It's the Immune Deficient Foundation's website. They are incredible at being advocates for the patients, but also the information on the site really, really help you understand what it is we deal with and go through. And I always like to say that for those that are wondering and saying, I wonder if I need to get tested, just look and see, am I having severe infections? Are they persistent? Are they unusual? The reoccurrence? Does my family have the same thing? And don't be afraid to speak up and ask your doctor, say, hey, can you test my immune system? It's not that big a deal. It's a little bit of blood draw and it's done. And get started. And if you want to really look into CVID, a friend of Steve Finch has a site, CVIDawareness.org, and he has great resources and information about CVID. Try for Better is all about a cause. It's about inspiration. I've not built it out to raise awareness and information, and we will add more, but you can go visit trackerbetter.com. But the real purpose is to really just challenge people to get moving.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. It's really a hard one to listen to if you don't know, if you haven't gone through it. It's tough. And I wish you a lot of luck at Ironman. Thank you so much for talking with me this evening. And Try for Better.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
David Brumley joined me from his home where he also works. It's his office in McKinney, Texas. Quite the story. Quite the story. Tryforbetter.com. So if you're interested in PI, the immunodeficiency, and some of the work that David's doing, you can check him out on his website. We're going to take a short break on The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be back and we'll be talking with Paul Sherwin. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
On Friday, June 6th, you can attend Share Your Draft, a fundraising benefit to support the nonprofit Bike Cleveland organization. Guests of Share Your Draft will enjoy locally produced appetizers and beverages as they learn how to help Bike Cleveland make riding a bicycle safer, more accessible, and fun for people of all ages and abilities. Share Your Draft takes place from 5 to 9 p.m. at the Dunham Tavern Museum on Euclid Avenue in Cleveland's Midtown District. Advance tickets and more information at shareyourdraft.eventbrite.com.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
We're heading over to Uganda, where it's a little bit later in the day. And I did have to do this earlier just to make sure everything went well. We did this interview by Skype. We're going to talk with Paul Sherwin. Paul, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
It's a pleasure to speak to the United States all the way from the heart of Africa.
Really? How's Africa today? You said dark when we talked.
Well, it's just coming up to 7 o'clock here in the middle of Africa. It goes dark. In fact, I live right on the equator, so it goes dark within the same 15 minutes the whole year round.
That's interesting. So that means your temperature's fairly temperate also, about the same year round, yes?
That's right, yeah. The only thing, we have four seasons. Two rainy seasons, the short rains and the long rains, and two hot seasons. And the temperature is about the same all the time. We don't have any air conditioning in the house, and we don't have any heating.
So what season is it right now?
We're just about coming to the end of the long rains, which have actually extended a little bit. They normally finish around the end of April, but they've been a bit longer this year.
Yes, climate change.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we'll talk about cycling a little bit. What do you say?
Sounds like a good idea.
I guess that's what the people want to hear. That's what they tell me anyway. So most of the people who are listening to our show know you as one of the voices of the Tour de France and many other big cycling races. But you actually go back pretty far historically as a cyclist and a team manager. Tell us a little bit about your history.
Yeah, well, basically, my history started in Africa before I went to the UK to go to school and university. And when I got to university, that's when I started cycling to get away from swimming, which I found boring. Swimming up and down the Black Line was not a lot of fun, so I started cycling to get out into the countryside and try and find the wide open spaces that I had growing up in Africa. And that's when I got to university, I got a coach, and did quite well and represented Great Britain. Once I finished university, I thought, well, you know, nowadays kids have a gap year before they go to university. Well, I finished university and decided I would have my gap year afterwards. Went and raced in France for 6 months and got myself a pro contract.
And what was that team?
That was a team called Fiat. Well, the amateur team was the ACBB, the Athletic Club Boulogne-Billancourt, which is a big omnisports club in the middle of Paris, which still exists today. And then my first professional team was the Fiat team, which was run by Raphael Geminiani.
So that was Italian team?
Well, it was an Italian sponsor, but it was actually Fiat from France who sponsored it. And Raphael Geminiani was a Frenchman with a very Italian-sounding name.
I guess. Who would have thought? And so how long were you with that team?
I was with that team for 2 years. And then I joined a team called La Redoute, which was based in the north of France. In fact, the head office of La Redoute is in Roubaix, and that's a name that you might have heard of because that's at the end of quite a well-known bicycle race, which takes place over 1 day. Yeah, and that was, I rode for them for 6 years, then I raced for Rally for 2 years. And once I retired from Rally, I managed the team for a couple of seasons.
And then, so how did you transition from racing and team management into the cycling analysis type work that you do now?
I think I would blame that on Phil Liggett.
We can blame a lot on him, can't we?
I blame most things on Phil Liggett. No, as I was about to retire from racing in Europe, Channel 4 in the UK were about to start a lot bigger coverage. That was back in 1986. So, in fact, the last 2 years that I raced, I actually started commentating for the Channel 4 Tour de France program in the UK. And I continued even through the team management years. And even when I went on to become a public relations officer at Motorola, I continued doing my television work. So I started all the way back in 1986.
Wow, that's a long time.
Well, I can't remember that far back, actually. I have to take notes.
That's like 28 years.
It's my 28th or 29th year of commentating with Phil Liggett this year, and my 36th year at the Tour de France.
Wow, that's a long history.
Your response to that is, Paul, you don't seem so old.
Oh, Paul, you just don't seem like you could possibly be that old. Now, Phil, on the other hand, of course.
Now, yeah, that was good. Now, in television, what they'd say was that was really good, but could you say it again with a little bit more emotion?
Well, I don't do television, see. I have a face for radio. There you go.
Whoa.
So you and Phil do seem to have a lot of information at your fingertips. I watch, I listen, and I'm always amazed at how much you know about all the teams, all the riders, all of the stages, everything. What kinds of technologies are you using? How do you keep up with all that rider information besides having it all in your brain?
Well, I mean, even today, I'm sitting in Africa, right on the edge of Lake Victoria, which is a lake twice the size of Holland at 26,000 square miles. And I was actually, with the power of the internet nowadays, I was watching the stage of the Giro d'Italia. So nowadays, it's much easier to keep in contact with what's going on. And Phil and I keep our own database. There's a lot of databases out around, you know, on the internet now, and there's some very, very good ones, but we actually keep our own personal ones, keeping up to date with all the riders, what they've done, you know, what their wives' names are, what their kids' names are, you know, when they were born, how many wins they had up until last year, how many wins they've got, and then on the other side of it, you know, there's a lot of history, and I spend a lot of, I'm interested in history, I'm interested in stories, I'm interested in geology, so I try and, when we go to an event, I try and find out each stage. I try and find out some tidbits about the stage because, funnily enough, the cyclists know more than we do about cycling anyway. So I'm actually, when I think about the commentating, I'm actually commentating to your mum or your uncle or your auntie who knows nothing at all about cycling. And they get pulled in by the other things that make cycling interesting because cycling is not just a stadium. You know, it's not the... it's not a basketball arena or it's not a football stadium. It's actually the countryside, and the countryside changes every day and changes with every event. So there's a lot more you can wind into your storytelling.
And it's all interesting. I'm always amazed at the kinds of things I learn by listening to you. So think back to some of your more memorable races that you've been covering. Tell us one or two of your favorites. Do you have a couple?
Every race is different, and every Tour de France is different. I mean, I love the one-day classics. I love Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders. They stand out to me. If I take all the one-day classics, Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders stand out so much more to me because those were two races that I used to get very, very motivated for myself. Those are races from a different era. Those are, you know, wars of attrition. Everybody's going to have bad luck. And you have to fight back from that in those races if you want to be up there. And at the end of the day, even with the television coverage, you cannot, because it's happening live, you don't know half of the stories that are going on. You only even find out a lot of the stories the next day and you know, the week after or 2 weeks after, because there is so much goes on in a race like that of guys who've fallen into a bed of nettles or crashed into a barbed wire fence and got up and fought back from 3 minutes down to get back into the group they were with. So, you know, those two races are always very, very motivating for me. The Tour, everybody asks about the Tour. You know, every Tour has its own different story. You know, Greg LeMond's comeback in 1989 is, you know, one of the greatest because I predicted he couldn't do it. And Liggett actually said, we did this before the start of the stage. And Phil asked me the question, well, you know, who's going to win? I said, well, obviously Fignon's going to win because he's got such a big advantage. It's a downhill time trial. 24 kilometers, there's no way you can pull back that amount of time. And Phil said, well, I believe Greg LeMond's going to win by 5 or 6 seconds. And that was on camera. So afterwards, I said to Lee, why do you say that? I said that was ridiculous. And he said, well, if I'd said that I agreed with you, everybody would have turned off and nobody would have watched.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, of course.
Well, as it turns out, he was absolutely right.
I know.
Well, for a couple of seconds, anyway. For a couple of seconds.
Yeah. I'm talking with Paul Sherwin. He is, as everybody who listens to any of the great cycling races, the voice of cycling, along with his sidekick, Phil Liggett. And I'm sure Phil would appreciate that. And he is speaking to us from his home in Uganda. When are you heading back over to the continent?
Well, I was just in the States for the Tour of California,
right?
Which I really enjoyed. It was a great race this year. It's a beautiful state and a great state to have a bike race in. I'm heading back in a couple of weeks. I'm going to England a week before the start of the Tour de France to take advantage of it starting in the United Kingdom to go and see some friends and family.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, I want to ask a little bit about some opinion. Since the days of Festina and all the other scandals, how do you keep such a positive perspective on cycling?
Well, I think, you know, there's two ways of looking at life. You can look at everything in a negative way or look at things in a positive way.
True.
I like to think, and I mean, I've been caught out several times, as many, many people with the sport. But I like to think about when I'm looking at the Tour de France, I'm not looking at a guy saying, you know, I wonder what anabolic steroid he had for breakfast, or I wonder if he did testosterone patches last week. I'm looking at the pictures. It's like I'm walking through an art gallery. I'm looking at the image that the race is going through, and I look at the beauty. Because if you stop that picture, forget about the rest. If you stop that picture and look at the peloton going through a field of poppies, going through a field of sunflowers, or going over a majestic mountain climb, that's the magic. People always ask me about all the bad things that have happened in the sports, and, you know, why I don't get depressed about it, and why, you know, when cycling's taken so many knocks, why I keep a positive view. I always like to look on the bright side, almost a cue for a song, and look on the bright side of life, Monty Python. But it's, you know, when I look at a stage of the Tour de France, if you freeze the frame, more often than not, you can look at the image of the race going through a poppy field or going through the sunflower seeds or going over a mountain pass, and it's beautiful. It's like a painting. It's like walking through an art gallery. And that's what I'm trying to pass on, my interpretation of what I'm looking at, rather than thinking about the bad things. I mean, when you drive, if you want to try driving down the road in Kampala, if you think the cycling's had a lot of bad knocks, it's blooming dangerous trying to cross the road in Kampala. Traffic, how bad it is.
Interesting.
Well, I smile.
Yeah, but you smile. Exactly. Well, what are you going to do? Cry about it? Sure, I understand. Let's talk a little bit about this year's tour. Do you have any ideas about who we might be watching?
It's always hard. People always ask me a month, 6 weeks before the Tour de France, you know, who's going to do well. But right now, we're coming into what I always regard as the critical time to give the indicators as to who's going to be good. We're coming up to the Dauphiné. We're coming up to the Tour of Switzerland. Those are the two events that you look at to get an indication of who's on track. I think Chris Froome is. I'd really like Chris Froome to be back on track, because obviously there's a little bit of an African link there for me, because Chris Froome grew up in Nairobi, educated in South Africa. So I'm probably the only journalist on the Tour de France who can speak to him in a native language, which is Swahili, because he speaks Swahili as well as I do. So I'm hoping that he'll be able to come back and confirm that, you know, what he did last year.
Well, Wiggins did well in California.
Wiggins, I thought, rode very, very well in California. And what was more important than him riding well was he seemed to be happy. He seemed to be relaxed. And that, to me, is the important thing, because I think I never thought that Wiggins could win the Tour de France, but I think he pushed himself right to the limit physically and mentally to get through 2012, with the Olympics being in the UK and London in 2012. I think at the end of that year, I don't mean he snapped, but I think he just decompressed, is the word the French would use. He just let it all go, and he found it hard getting back into the motivation in 2013. This year he's changed his goals. He's thinking forward to the next Olympic Games. He's ridden Paris-Roubaix, which he enjoyed. He thinks, wow, I'm in the top 10 here. Flipping heck. He's looking around and with, you know, Tom Boonen and Fabian Cancellara. And when I saw him at California, I thought, this is a Wiggins from 2 or 3 years ago. It's going to be tough, though, as to whether or not they put him in the team. And that's going to be the next. That's going to be the next bit of scandal that will come out of Team Sky. But I think they might have to put him in the team. You know, with the injuries they've had this year, I think it'll be a tough call to leave Wiggins out of the tour team.
The last thing I want to talk about is, do you have a favorite stage of the tour? Now, it's starting in a different place this year. It'll, of course, end as it always does, down the Champs-Élysées. But do you have a favorite stage of the Tour de France, one that you just love reporting on?
I always love Alpe d'Huez. I mean, if I have to, that came to my mind straight away, because I've got so many memories of riding Alpe d'Huez myself when I rode the tour. I rode Alpe d'Huez. I mean, Last year they rode the Alpe d'Huez on two occasions. I rode Alpe d'Huez when they had two stages finishing at Alpe d'Huez. We finished up it one day, started at the bottom the next day and did a loop, then came back up it, and then had a rest day the next day, and our team manager made us ride back up it. So Alpe d'Huez holds a little bit of a special place in my heart.
Yeah, not always 100% positive. It's like, really? We have to do this again?
Yeah, no, Alpe d'Huez is special. It's a great place. I mean, I think it's fantastic. It is an iconic climb. But so, you know, so too then is the Mont Ventoux. But I think, you know, off the top of my head, Alpe d'Huez comes up to me on top, which is amazing for me to say that as the best non-climber in the whole of the Tour de France's history.
Is that so?
I was pathetic. My nickname was Climber when I climbed, when I raced, because I was such a bad climber.
I want to ask you something personal, if you don't mind, and that is, you've done a lot of things that people don't know about. Everybody thinks of you as the voice of the Tour de France and other races, of course, but pick one of the things that you've done and just tell us a little bit about it. I know the one that that just blew me away, but I'll let you tell me which you prefer.
Yeah, well, I've been involved in a number of businesses and still involved in a number of businesses in Uganda. I think probably one of the things that's given me the greatest pleasure, apart from having been a safari guide, I love taking people on safari. I've never taken anybody to a safari in Kenya or Uganda who's gone away with a negative view of the African continent. And the more people you bring to Africa, the more people realize how amazing a place it is. And in fact, there's a guy called Ashish Thakkar who did a big presentation today. He's one of the youngest millionaires in Africa. And he said, forget about China, forget about India. The new place, the new development is Africa. And I think that is, people have forgotten about Africa. It's been regarded as the dark continent. Watch out for Africa over the next 10 years, because that's where there's going to be major development.
I think that's awesome. Well, I really, really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today.
Well,
Let me
just finish off. One thing that
Absolutely.
I'm really, really proud of
okay.
is actually starting a small welding company in Kampala, which has certified 40 Ugandan welders up to international standards with Lloyd's of London register and the American Petroleum Institute certification. And that has made me very proud, because people say, oh, you can't do this because Africa is so far behind. Well, we can, and we've done it. And that's why I believe in Africa. And that's why I believe Africa's got a great future ahead of it. And let's not forget, your colleague, Jonathan Boyer.
I was just going to mention him.
Yep. He's my neighbor. Well, he's about 10 hours away from here, and he has set up an unbelievable program for training cyclists in Rwanda. And I'd love to have the time and the power to do that in Uganda and in East Africa, what Jock has done just across the border. So watch out for the African cyclists. I mean, today was Colombia's day in the Giro d'Italia, but I think in the next few years, you'll see African cyclists coming to the fore as well.
Well, that's what Jacques and Kimberly say, and I have to believe them. They're doing very, very well, and we've spoken with them several times on the show. I've been watching the Rwandan teams, and now Kimberly, of course, is doing all this work with women cyclists.
I think the Tour of California Amgen did a great job in increasing the number of days to two days for the women's racing. The women were fantastic at the Amgen Tour of California. And I think women's cycling is on a rise all around the world, not just in the United States or in Australia or in Europe. It's coming up all around the globe. And it's great to see, and it's great to see the support.
I agree. Well, on that note, I'm going to let you get back to what you're doing. I know it's nighttime where you are. Thank you so much for talking with me. Have fun at the tour this year, and we'll talk again.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
All right, Paul. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Paul Sherwin joined me from his home in Uganda, and as expected, what a wonderful human being, and he certainly has his interesting things to say about Mr. Phil Liggett. Well, I hope you enjoyed our show. It was action-packed tonight. We will be back next week, same time, 5:30 p.m., on The Outspoken Cyclist. Hope you get a chance to ride. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.